Welcome to Let's Talk Canine Fitness with your hosts, Katerina Mattioli and Dr. Leslie I. Join us for the monthly podcast on all things dog fitness. Young, old, overweight, or athletic, our passion for canine fitness has you covered. Hi, Katerina. How are things going?
Hi, Leslie. Oh, things are going very well, but I'm a little bit tired because I'm on puppy watch. We have puppies. They turn 1 week old, and I'm now right now sitting next to mommy and the puppies and have fun. How are you doing?
I'm good. I don't have anything as exciting as puppies, but happy Thanksgiving. That's exciting.
Thanksgiving. We don't celebrate that here, but happy Thanksgiving to you.
Yeah, so that's about the only excitement I have. Yeah, I know. Puppies doing well?
Puppies are doing well. I'm a little bit tired, but puppies are awesome. They are so cute. And mom is the best mom ever.
Good. Let's see. So I guess we should talk about what we're doing today. We're doing mini-sode number 6.
Yeah. Yes. Already.
I know. It's crazy. So we have some great patron questions that we want to get through today. We got 4 of them, and they're really, really good questions. So what do you think? We ready to just go ahead and get started?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go. Let's see. What's our first question? Oh, our first question is from Rebecca. And of course, she asked a question that required some research, which is always good. So in the last episode, we talked about injuries caused by obedience. I can't remember exactly when in the episode it came up, but I agree. I think we just kind of briefly mentioned it, didn't really talk about it very much.
Was it injuries? I thought maybe just problems caused, not exactly injuries, I guess.
Yeah. Something like that. Mm. And then we talked about, or we didn't. So Rebecca asked that she was asking, do we think it's due to the flashy heads up style of healing? Mm-hmm. And then can we kind of elaborate on it, go more into styles of healing that are not problematic for the dog and useful conditioning exercises for healing? So Rebecca, what I did, because neither of us compete in obedience.
Nope.
But I do at least live with someone who is fairly active in the sport and pretty into it. So I have somewhat a little bit of knowledge about training for it and competing, but you know, not a lot of personal knowledge. So I did some research. And what's interesting is, unlike agility, cane across, fly ball even, there really haven't been any studies done on injuries and obedience and like correlation at all. So, I mean, I did a whole search in all the different ways I know how, and really nothing came up. So that for those of you listening that are interested, looking for a research project, that might be something interesting to do, is to start out with a survey of obedience competitors and what kind of injuries their dogs have had over the years. So anyway, what I found a few things. So I did find some, let's see, one article from Veterinary Integrated Physiotherapy from 2010 that talked about the potential for muscle tension and repetitive strain injuries. And I think that really does probably relate to the heel pattern, the style of healing, and the fact that we do tend to want more of this flashy heads up heel, and it's not really a natural gait
and natural posture.
Yeah. So. Yeah. The rear end really tucked under the dog and kept more in flexion, while the front end is more in extension. Then I also found Canine Massage Therapy Center, an article from 2015. And that talked about strained muscles and the possibility for strained muscles and torn tendons, neck spasms, back pain, shoulder problems, and stiffness. And again, this is not any kind of correlation. It is just kind of an article talking about experience, what massage therapists might find working on obedience dogs, and what to kind of check for. So it did not have any kind of statistics of the likelihood of these problems. The one thing I did find, and we will link to this in the show notes, is I did find a really cool kinetics paper. And it was it's titled "An Examination of Neck Angle in Obedience Dogs Whilst Completing Competition Heel Work." And it is from Comparative Exercise Physiology in 2017. Now, they were just looking at the neck angle and the score the dog received. They were not looking at any kind of injury. But what they found was that there was no significant correlation between the judges' scores and the apparent neck angle of competitive obedience dogs. So I thought that was really interesting. There's basically what they were kind of alluding to is there's no reason to do this flashy kind of heads up heel work, because it is, it doesn't get you higher scores. So we're not, and they even mentioned they're not really sure where it's coming from. Why, you know, if that's what the problem is, why is it happening? You know, why do we keep doing it? So it's, you know, like I said, just kind of one of those interesting kind of things to think about in obedience. If people want to do this kind of flashy healing, heads up healing, what kind of fitness exercises do we think would help protect the dog, protect them?
So from my experience, I would say what my biggest concern is this head position. And I always try to look that you can level this out, and that you that the neck that you strengthen the neck, etc., and look that you can level it out with fore and after care as well.
Yeah, for me, and again, I don't compete in obedience, so it's hard for me to like promote this. I feel like I would push as a fitness, as a rehab person, push for obedience people to work more with a neutral head position.
Yeah.
I think if you look at most obedience regulations, like the head position is not commented on at all in the scoring. It's more about, you know, the legs, the relationship of the shoulder to the person.
The body position, not exactly the head position.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would try and promote a more normal head position. And then I would, you know, fitness wise kind of do you know, your normal fitness. Like I would probably actually just, you know, look at overall body, what it takes to for the dog to work in heel position and, you know, be prepared for the speed changes, be prepared for the turns. I think that's more what the focus should be on than like trying to protect the neck because you want them to do this flashy heads up heel position. I don't know. That's my thought. I'm gonna change a lot of minds.
Oh, I don't think so either. It's just coming from a sport where you like a very flashy appearance, but a very natural appearance. Is it for me always very disturbing to look at these gates and look at these head positions, and to me it doesn't it's not something I would like to do my dogs, because it looking at it hurts me. So because I'm like, ouch. And so I would look, yeah, it's just doing overall fitness to strengthen the whole body, that the body is ready for these things. But I think aftercare to work these muscles that are used is very important in that sport, because it's sort of unnatural position.
I think more than anything, like I don't know, because like I think of it in comparison to agility, where we get a lot of criticism for overtraining, but at least the dog is like in control of its body. You know, we're not necessarily telling them to change their gait from point A to point B, because
you don't put the dog in a certain frame. It's just the dog is the dog.
Yeah. In obedience, the training, the competing is very much like constantly trying to get the dog in this position and to maintain this position, but it's not a natural position. So I think that's where like kind of the difference is between like obedience and agility. So, I don't know. It's interesting. And I really do think it would be good for someone to try and study it and figure out if
that is. Absolutely. I would like that.
Yeah.
Because it's very interesting. And
yeah. And it's not something we know about. And yet it's probably, what is it? It's probably like one of the oldest dog sports out there. Besides like conformation. Like I feel like, you know, conformation was first and then obedience was second, right? Mm-hmm. So it was a little disappointing to me that I couldn't find a lot of information about it. The one other thing I wanted to mention before we move on to the next question was that in that cool kinetics paper that I found, they did note that many dogs actually developed a pacing gait during heel work, instead of being able to maintain or move into a trot and maintain a trot, a lot of them learned it was better just to pace with the handler. So I thought that was kind of an interesting little fact that they noted as well. So, okay, let's move on to question 2 and 3 kind of together, because they were both asked by Alyssa. And so the first question she asked was, can you talk through recovery from injury and the point at which you are doing rehab versus strength building, and how to know where you're at in that process? And the first thing I'm going to do is say that I'm going to kind of change the wording of this question a little bit, because I think when you're doing rehab, you are doing strength building.
Yeah.
So I think what the question really was asking is when you are doing rehab versus when you are doing return to sport.
Okay.
And how do you know where you're at in that process? That's what I think.
I think that's we already covered that a little bit in that episode we had, fitness versus rehab.
Yeah.
So
Yeah. And the biggest thing I wanted to say for this is like, there's not really a line, right? Like, I don't, when I'm dealing with a patient, I don't think, okay, these first 6 weeks is rehab, and then the second 6 weeks is return to sport. It's more like you start doing rehab, and as you go along, you might start sprinkling in a little bit more return to sport exercises. And then as you get further and further along, you're doing less and less rehab type exercises and more return to sport type exercises. And so for me, it's about, and I do think we maybe talked about this, but for me, it's I'm trying to get more into the mode of functional assessments rather than time-based assessments. So kind of traditionally, I think in rehab, we did talk a lot about like the first 8 weeks is rehab, and then the dog should be healed. And then, you know, if they're a pet dog, they can just go home and be normal. But if they're a sport dog, then we need to do a little bit more. For me, rather than having those like specific time markers, I think it's more important to be like, okay, when the dog is fully weight bearing on the injured leg, that means I can now start these exercises. When the dog has full range of motion of that joint, now I can start these exercises. When the dog can do 10 rock back sit to push forward stands without any fatigue or break in form, now I can start jumping exercises. So that's how I'm trying to look at it. And those things may happen all at different times, right? And so there's not really a clear defining point of like when one thing ends and the other begins.
To me, these time frames are sort of giving the dog owner an idea of how long it can take. It's just yeah, so because it's very individual, and then but the owner always wants to know how long will it take, how when can we go back to do whatever they do, and so these set time frames are for me are like, yeah, you have to maybe 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks, to give them a certain point where they work towards to, and where they can maybe see progress, or hopefully see progress. So this is how I see it. I don't, as always, I always look at the dog. I'm not I'm I and look at it as an individual, and then from my position, I'm not a veterinarian, so I have I communicate with the vet with the surgeon or veterinarian, and not as me as a therapist. I get advice, and then we have a point to discuss. So it's different from what you do.
Well, I think I do similar too, that I use the timeline as an estimate. So I talk a little bit more about time in the beginning of like, okay, well, this is how long it takes something like this to heal. And, you know, then, you know, so I can give them a bit of like an estimate of, okay,
What they
yeah,
have to expect.
it'll be this long before you're back to competing. But as for like more specific, I think we do ourselves a disservice if we try and base everything on time. Because if you say something like, okay, at 6 weeks, we should be able to be jumping. And then you get to 6 weeks and they're not ready for jumping yet, they're gonna feel like a failure. And so that's why I'd rather say, okay, well, when we get to 10 push forward sit to stands or rock back sit to push forward stands in good form without fatigue, then we're ready for jumping. It's not necessarily a failure if you like you try that at 6 weeks and they can't do it. It's just like, oh, okay, dog showed us that they're not ready for it yet. So I don't know.
I say I to tell them this is what we can expect, hopefully, but it's always age related, breed related, it's individual. It's not no pressure, but hopefully till then it is better. If it's earlier, wonderful. If it's later, no problem.
Yeah.
We work on
that.
So to don't put them under pressure.
Yeah. Kind of jumping off from that question.
Mm-hmm.
Alyssa's next question was, how much agility is too much agility? How is someone supposed to know how much their dog can handle? I think, again, that's kind of, it's going to be very individual. It's kind of like, you know, if your dog is always getting hurt, or if your dog is, you know, not wanting to do it, you're probably doing too much agility. But if, you know, if they're doing it and not having any problems, then it's probably fine. Like, I don't know. I guess, like, in this question, you know, I just relate it a lot to athletics in people, and the fact mm-hmm. that most athletes, you know, that become like this, you know, the big names, like the Olympic athletes and professional athletes, you know, a lot of that started when they were younger. And it's very intense. You know, if I think about like my own type of swimming training, it is much more intense than any kind of agility training that I do with my dogs. I mean, I don't think I could do, I'm trying to think of like, okay, when I was in high school, I was in the pool like somewhere between 3 to 5 hours a day. And that doesn't include, like, that's actual pool time, not even including like weights and other type of training that went into it.
But just your sport, the sport you,
yeah, just
you're competing it.
Doing, you know, actually swimming. And I'm like, I can't imagine doing that much a day with a dog of like agility. You know, even if I have a day where I get out and like go for a hike, if I get some fitness training in and some agility skill training in, probably it's maybe at the maximum it would be 3 hours. I think even that, like, most likely it's not, because if I'm going to do all three things in a day, probably their hike was pretty short. Like, probably it was an hour at most. And then, you know, I've got 15, 20 minutes of a fitness workout. And then honestly, for agility training, it's probably less than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So that would still end up being under 2 hours. So, you know, I can't, it's one of those things where I look at how much human athletes go through to prepare for their sport. And I really don't think we're anywhere near that for the dogs. And not that I'm saying we should be, but I think if you're doing, you know, just kind of a normal amount of training and agility, and your dog is getting injured a lot, then you are probably doing too much, and you should scale it back. Or work on preparing them for it, like by doing other things. So
I would compare it to kids, human athletes. So that you have this, what is happening when a kid is, when you have these moms who push their kids into sports, and to, so what is happening if a kid doesn't want to do it? They become moody, they don't want to go, they start doing other things. And I yeah. think that's what I'm doing with my dogs. When I see their behavior changes, when you look at your dog and the behavior changes, then that's the point to look, where is the problem? Is what are we overdoing? What is, yeah, that this is what I think is important, to just watch your dog. That
yeah, and I think what you said about kids also, like, it made me think a little bit more about like my timeline in mm-hmm. athletics. So like as a young very young kid, like under 10 years old. So what we might consider like under a year old for a dog, you know, at most I was probably had like an hour, hour and a half in the pool a day. And it was very relaxed, you know, was a lot less intensity. It was still the time was put in, but it was more focused on technique. Mm-hmm. And because early on, that's where you get to develop good habits, right? So you want to work on how you're moving while you're swimming, and you want to, you know, be more focused on that and thinking about your body. And I think that correlates to our dogs as well, because we try, like we say, let's, you know, when it's they're young, let's work on body awareness. Let's work on promoting exactly how they should be moving, rather than letting them develop bad habits that then we have to break when they're older.
It's setting the basics.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then as I got older and older and older, that's when it was like you pushed and pushed and pushed for more stamina, more intensity, as you became more competitive in the sport. And I think we can very much like correlate that same type, that same thought process with our dog sports.
I agree.
Cool. Okay. Well, hopefully, I mean, that's a hard question to answer. Like, how much agility is too much agility? I mean, it's very dependent for every dog. I'm not sure, like, you know, people talk about, oh, they only have so much in them. And maybe that's true. But the thing is, we don't know, like they don't come with a card when they're born saying, I have 100 hours of agility in me. Use it wisely. Versus, you know, the litter mate might come and say, well, I have 300 hours of agility yeah in me. So it's, you know,
I think when we compare it to conformation, when you see there is this typical show dog, and mm-hmm you see when it's when they are overdone, they are flat. So they mm when they come and are young and they want to do it, they shine. And at some point when they are dragged around for years, and every weekend they have shows, they turn to be they are flat. You can see yeah it's not this shine, this sparkle is away. And I think it's the same with agility and all other sports.
I agree. I think that just made me think that the true question is not how much agility is too much agility, but how much competition is too much competition. Mm-hmm. Because I think the dogs can do a lot of training for agility without issue. But I do think, just like you said, they can get burnt out when you're like yep going to trial after trial, weekend after weekend after weekend. Because what tends to happen in agility too is like when you're doing it that way, you let things go in the trial. You know, you don't hold to your criteria. And so basically then you go to the trial, you know, things happen, you lose certain criteria, and then you have to spend the whole next week trying to fix that criteria. Yeah. And then only to go to a trial again, in which fact you probably haven't had enough time to fix it. So then you get this cycle, and the dogs get burnt out because they're frustrated. They don't understand. You get frustrated because they're not being successful.
And it's not no longer fun.
Exactly.
And I think that the important thing is to keep it fun for both.
Yeah.
Handler and dog. It has to be fun. The training has to be fun. Competition has to be fun. Okay. We all want to win. That's why we are competing. We want to win, but we have to find the balance between that we want to win and the way we go to that win. So it need, and fun is one of the basic principles. Yeah. If you don't like, if the competitor doesn't like the sport, success won't come.
Yeah, I agree. Cool. Okay, let's move on to our final question from Bridget. Yay.
It fits.
Which also, yes, another research question. So Bridget asked, are there certain exercises that should be avoided during a bitch's heat cycle? Also, what role should fitness training play during pregnancy and post-whelping? So, Katarina, do you want to talk about like your experience first, and then I'll jump in a little bit with what I could find research wise.
Yeah.
And hopefully that will answer the question.
That sounds good. You can come with all the hormone things.
Yes.
And I will we'll talk about my personal experience. As I'm a breeder, I have a lot of personal experience with bitches in heat and fitness training. So it's what I'm always watching is that when my bitches are in heat, and if a litter is planned or not, I just don't overdo it, because I looked at my because when the bitch is going into heat, the body, it's like with us women, the body is loosening, ligaments are loosening, so this is not helping in preventing injuries. So I work slower, I work close to the ground, the equipment I'm using is not as instable as it is when the bitch isn't in the heat process. Or but we are doing fitness exercises. They are not sick. I just watch more that that they don't get injured.
You were talking about the pastern or the hawk, or I forget which one that you.
Yeah, as you already know, I'm someone who is looking a lot at the dogs.
Yes.
I look at how is my dog standing, and when you can see that bitches in heat, most of the bitches in heat are going low down on their pasterns. So this is what I'm looking. This is my point. Okay, we have to pay attention now because everything is loosening. So this is when we start looking, and then when I see that the pasterns are becoming better again. Not as loose as they were, they are stronger. I think, okay, I can increase now the difficulty of the exercises. So there, it's like, it's very individual. It's like everything we have I can't say you have to do it 3 weeks this, 2 weeks this, 4 weeks that. You have to start. I'm just looking at my bitches, and then I decide, okay, your pasterns are not as weak as they were 1 week ago. So we slightly start to increase the difficulty of equipment, and maybe height of exercises or instability of exercises. So yeah, this is what I'm doing. There are exercises that can help bitches to tucking up better. Of course, we are doing a lot of core strength, and yeah.
So
hormones.
I do not have as much personal experience. I do have an entire bitch that I do agility with, but she cycles pretty infrequently, and I've never really, like, personally kind of never really changed things dramatically when I see she's coming in heat. But okay. Like I said, she's a little different in that usually the evidence of her being in heat is very slight, very minor. And so a lot of times it's kind of a surprise. It's like, one day suddenly the boys are like very interested, mm-hmm. and then it's done. I did try to find, you know, I went with the what evidence is out there with this, because I do actually get this question quite a bit, and do hear a lot of people saying like, It's very dangerous to be doing any kind of exercise when the bitch is in heat and stuff like that. So unfortunately, there's not a lot out there specifically looking at hormones and exercise or hormones and their relationship to injury. So again, another great research topic for those of you out there looking for something to do. What I did find, I went to first my old reliable resource. I think we've talked a little bit about it before, but my wonderful book, Care of the Racing and Retired Greyhound, for what they do with greyhounds when they are in season, pregnant and lactating. And then I also found a really cool blog from Online Pet Health called Does Heat Play a Role in Cranial Cruciate Ligament Tears? And what's important to realize is that the two hormones that we're worried about are prolactin, which helps with lactating, and relaxin, which is the hormone to help kind of increase ligament laxity, especially like the focus is actually on the pelvis for actually giving birth to kind of make it easier for the birth canal to widen so that the dogs can more easily give birth. What's noted in the Greyhound book is that prolactin also increases fat deposited in muscle. And so that maybe affects the muscle, but you know, it's a little bit unknown. Like I said, hasn't really been studied. And then in the Greyhound book, what they do, kind of the program that they recommend with greyhounds specifically for racing, is that the first 3 weeks when the dog is in heat, to be careful with like all out exercise. So they say that the dogs can be walked and they can do swimming, but they don't actually train them for racing or do any racing. They are careful with them during this time. The second 3 weeks, so this would be like after they have been bred and are potentially already pregnant, they say everything can be normal. You can return to completely normal activity, exercise, racing. But then the last 9 weeks, especially if the dog is pregnant or showing signs of pseudo pregnancy, you should go back to being careful again, where the dog can be walked, the dog can be swam, but they should not do any training for racing or racing. Now, we have to remember that like in these greyhounds, it's not like they're not doing any kind of fitness exercises like that we talk about. They're not doing instability equipment or sit to stands or stuff like that. They're really just walking, swimming, or training for racing. That's kind of their exercise level. So whether or not other things they might consider are okay is a little bit of an unknown. But basically, I would say, yes, there are times of the heat cycle and pregnancy that we should be cautious, just like with people. But I don't think we have to be overly cautious and be like, oh my God, they can't do anything. They have to just be, you know, contained and kept still and, you know,
it is important for the bitch to be active to for the delivery. They need to be fit that they can deliver the puppy. So
so I just wanted to quickly talk about the blog from Online Pet Health, because it's, while there definitely is some research out there looking at these hormones and different species, and potentially there is a link to the hormones increasing ACL tears in people, there have not been any specific studies looking at it in dogs. And the, especially with cranial cruciate tears, I just feel I have to say, like, as the vet, it is a multifactorial issue. It's not just hormones, you know, playing the main role. There's lots of different factors that go into why a dog might tear its cruciate ligament. But I guess if you think your dog is at risk and it's an intact female, then I would potentially be even more careful as it, you know, when it's going into heat. So
that's, I would say in the process, it's just because they are, everything is loosening. The joints are more unstable, and instability is leading to that they are, that injuries can happen. Yeah, that's the key point.
Potentially more likely injuries could happen.
Yeah.
I do think, I'm going to say, you know, I think if your dog is a very fit dog and kept in good shape, the chance of it happening is probably still very low, because even if the ligaments loosen slightly, they should have the muscle control keeping the joint stable. I think the dogs that are less fit, it's just another additional
one on top
factor that they could tear. Yeah.
Yeah. I just tell my clients, just be careful in this period, because we know it is happening. Look at your dogs and then decide. But just be careful. Don't overdo it, but do something, because it's the bitch is needed, if they are bred or not.
Yeah.
Because when they aren't bred, the possibility of a false pregnancy is there, so the process is longer than if there is no false pregnancy. So just,
yeah,
if having an intact bitch is maintenance.
Cool. Well, that wraps up all our patron questions. So, do you have anything else you want to comment on?
I don't think so. I said I'm
Well, then I was going to say, let's wrap up this mini-sode. Thank you so much to our patrons for all the questions. You guys really come up with great questions, and I have to say it's very enjoyable. For me, at least, giving me things to look into, because I, you know, sometimes don't think about these things, and it's always great to, like, start looking into other aspects of fitness and dogs, how, you know, their health affects it.
So. And it's interesting the points that they are looking at, when what we may not think about. It's just like, oh, okay, yeah, and doing the research. That's great. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, then we're going to sign off. So remember,
stay fit and stay in the game.
Bye, guys.
Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk Canine Fitness. If you enjoyed our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and online at www.letstalkcaninefitness.com. Want some bonuses? Support us on Patreon. Every month we will release a mini-sode exclusively from Patreon questions. Plus, other special bonuses you will find only on the Let's Talk Canine Fitness Patreon page. This episode was produced by Leslie Ide and Caterina Mattioli. Music written and performed by Moonfly. Music provided by PremiumBeat.com.